From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump signed an executive order today on police reform, following yet another night of protests from coast to coast that have put pressure on cities to take action on their own. New York City has disbanded its anti-crime unit, a team of plainclothes officers that was involved in many high-profile police shootings in the city. And in Atlanta, days after the police killing of Rayshard Brooks, Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms announced her own executive orders on the use of force and de-escalation tactics.
The president's executive order outlines an effort to track officer misconduct nationwide, incentivize better police training by tying programs to grants, and include trained experts like social workers and mental health workers on more calls. Speaking before the signing, Trump defended law enforcement and attacked calls to defund police departments.
Americans know the truth. Without police, there is chaos. Without law, there is anarchy. And without safety, there is catastrophe. We need leaders at every level of government who have the moral clarity to state these obvious facts.
NPR's White House correspondent Franco Ordonez is here. And Franco, tell us more. The president said chokeholds would be banned, except when an officer felt his or her life was in danger. Tell us more about that. Was that a surprise?
That was a bit of a surprise. I mean, we had heard that the administration wanted to put in some measures to increase certified, standards, but chokehold is something that was not necessarily expected, but that among higher training de-escalation techniques were a part of it. Another part was the database to track police officers, something activists have been wanting for a while, to track officers who have been had multiple complaints against them. Another issue they've sought is having social workers and mental health professionals join them on calls dealing with some of these issues such as homelessness, mental illness, and addiction. So those were interesting.
Vice President Pence and the order will show Americans that the administration is listening. What else might be in this order that Democrats in the House are suggesting in their proposal, which is said to have more teeth, things like mandating police cameras or banning no-knock warrants?
Well, I mean, the no-knock warrants were not discussed, and it's been an issue that certainly has drawn the attention not only of Democrats, but also several Republicans, such as Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, who has called for support. Another thing that Democrats really want that Republicans have said is a non-starter, including President Trump, is qualified immunity, which would make it easier to, to pursue criminal and civil action against police officers. President Trump said he would not support that. And certainly there are other issues that they are looking at. The challenge that the police departments face is that many of these departments are run at the state and local level, which makes widespread changes more difficult to enact. But the administration argues that they can use these federal grants to incentivize police departments to do the right thing. That said, they also acknowledge that, there is more challenges, and they will need the Attorney General to provide more specific guidance, and they'll need Congress to provide more funding to have a greater impact, to give it some teeth.
What are you hearing in the few seconds we have? Is this order a result of pressure from within the GOP?
Well, I mean, certainly it's not only Democrats who have been speaking out about this. Many Republicans have as well. And they, as we said before, have been discussing about banning chokeholds and ending no-knock warrants. The Republican-led Senate Judiciary Committee is taking up this issue of policing and community relations this afternoon, and we're waiting to see what Senate Republicans unveil in a bill this week. Senator Tim Scott is leading that effort, and we'll see, what it entails and what the White House will actually support.
We're hearing people like Van Jones, the activist, saying on CNN, it's a start. Is there anything that directly addresses, concerns about race, racial profiling, racism in law enforcement?
Yeah, I mean, Van Jones is talking about saying that this is a start. And that issue of racial profiling and racism is a big concern. This does not specifically address those concerns about, you know, that police treat African Americans and people of color unfairly. The officials say the focus is on breaking down barriers and working with law enforcement. We saw all the law enforcement standing behind President Trump, not demonizing the police. But look, the president has made very clear that his support is with the police, and he rejects the idea of systemic racism in policing.
Mm-hmm. NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, the president does have the power to sign an executive order and to direct federal agencies to do certain things, but the coronavirus pandemic has exposed some of the things the president doesn't have the power to do, like open and close the economy. States and localities have been the ones doing that, even as President Trump claimed he had total authority over them to reopen their states. Here's the president on April 13th.
The president of the United States has the authority to do what the president has the authority to do, which is very powerful. The president of the United States calls the shots.
Joining us now is Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Julian, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, in this debate over who holds the power, the federal government or the states, goes all the way back to the founding fathers of this country, but they were divided on this.
Absolutely. And in the end, we have a compromise where the states retain immense power over what happens in their territory. And the federal government has ways of overriding the states. The president and Congress can pass laws that are superior to what the states can do. But the states still were vested with immense authority, which has been a problem for federal power ever since the founding.
And in this moment, this is one of the biggest crises that this country has ever faced, but we have had some major signposts throughout history where this issue has come up, including the Civil War and the New Deal. How did leaders make their cases for or against states' rights during those events?
Well, states' rights has often been an argument to try to check the federal government. So in the New Deal, during the 1930s, it was a way for some conservatives to argue that the federal government couldn't do whatever it wanted to regulate the economy or create a social safety net. Or during the 1950s, Southern governors often used the states' rights argument to prevent civil rights initiatives from the federal government. But the federal government has still acted. Presidents have either used emergency powers or Congress has passed federal legislation, such as the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which did prohibit the states from doing whatever they wanted to do.
So what do you think about what you're seeing today in response to both the coronavirus pandemic and calls for police reform and the balance between the federal power and the power of the states?
Well, it's been interesting in that many states have actually taken the initiative rather than the federal government. So what we saw certainly with the pandemic were many states, red and blue, from Ohio to New York, acting ahead of what the federal government was willing to do. So even as President Trump was saying the power of the president is supreme, what actually happened was governors used their powers to do what Washington wasn't willing to do to fight the pandemic. And now we're seeing a little bit about this with criminal justice reform. In some states, there is movement to change policing. So the tension is playing out again, although this time the governors are the prime movers rather than the president.
Do you think that that's worked out to the benefit of the people to have the governors have more power in these two situations than the president?
I think in the end, what we always learn in these moments of crisis, we need the country to act in a united fashion. So even though it has allowed, since this all started, some states to take necessary steps, what we see is a patchwork of action. And some states are not doing what they need to do, other states are. And this is ultimately why we often turn to federal solutions. We need a united front. We can't have, with the pandemic, some states not taking proper courses of action and other states doing it because it doesn't work. And with criminal justice reform and civil rights, it actually has to be a national right. It can't be left to the states because we see what happens every day on our Twitter feed.
When you look at what the federal government is doing, and we've already had many trillions of dollars of economic relief passed by Congress and signed by the president, there may be a major police reform initiative that comes out of Washington in the coming weeks. Do you think that the federal government is meeting the moment right now?
I don't. Obviously, there has been a big stimulus package for the pandemic, but I'm very dubious that the government will take the necessary steps, certainly on criminal justice reform. There's a lot of opposition in the Republican Party. Republicans control the Senate, and they have been very hesitant to sign on to what Democrats in the House are proposing. And President Trump has been lukewarm in what he's willing to do. And with the pandemic, yes, we have the stimulus, but many other pieces of the puzzle, from the kind of testing that we need to the kind of support to healthcare institutions, has not been coming. And unless it does, I don't think the federal government can be said to handle this the right way.
That is Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Julian, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
So where are we in the global pandemic? In France, President Macron announced the surprise opening of indoor cafes, saying, "We will discover the art of living." But two women from the UK allowed to travel to virus-free New Zealand to visit a dying relative brought the virus with them, and Beijing is closing its recently opened schools. The U.S. now has over 116,000 deaths. Some models show 200,000 deaths by October as states continue to reopen, and 18 show a rise in cases. A headline from Tucson's Daily Star reads, "Arizona's COVID-19 infections spike 54% in a week." And look at this note in the Washington Post. 39% of people surveyed by the CDC have been using household cleaners in a very dangerous way, some gargling with bleach. The president suggested ingesting bleach might prevent COVID-19. It does not. Neither does hydroxychloroquine. The FDA has now revoked its approval of the drug for COVID-19, saying there's no evidence it treats or prevents it. But where are we on something that does, a vaccine? We're bringing back Lori Garrett, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Coming Plague, Newly Emerging Diseases in a World Out of Balance. She wrote it way before this pandemic. And Lori, when you were here in March, there had been 214,000 cases worldwide. Today, there are more than 8 million. What's your top of mind thought right now?
I think fundamentally the problem that we're facing all over the world, in every kind of country, in every kind of government, with just a handful of exceptions, is a failure of imagination, a failure to understand how serious the threat can be, and an overriding tension between the economic needs and exigencies of societies versus the need to control the virus. It's all, of course, much worse in countries where the governance is very poor and where government has already made its decision to side on the side of economics.
Well, when you say governments that have decided to side with the economics, do you think the U.S. has won? We have Treasury Secretary Mnuchin saying we can't shut down the economy again, regardless of rising cases. Then there's White House Economic Advisor Larry Kudlow on Fox News yesterday, who didn't seem to believe claims about rising cases. Let's listen.
We have better equipment. We have much more experience in handling these hotspots, small metropolitan areas. We are not intending to close down the economy. We do not believe this is a second wave.
Lori, is that what you're thinking of? And, you know, if you speak of a second wave, what are you speaking of?
Well, first of all, I don't think it's time to talk about a second wave. We haven't finished the first. What you're seeing now are the fluctuations of a first wave. A second wave is what's going on at this instant in Beijing, which is terrifying. What we're seeing is a very fragmented mosaic of public health and health governance, varying county by county, state by state, and no real serious national leadership forming any kind of coherent singular response. And so as you look around the country, you see us in New York coming out of our long lockdown, nevertheless opening slowly.
Well, and you also have Governor Cuomo saying, you know, threatening after this past weekend, I'm going to close it back down because he saw people packing restaurants and other places in the good summer weather. Do you recommend that? If, you know, if there's any sign that the curve starts to go the other way, go back, shut back down?
As the weather gets fantastic and you hit a lovely Friday or Saturday night, a lot of younger adults hit the streets, and the streets themselves become a kind of party scene. And that was what the governor was responding to. We've seen this multiple times, and each time it becomes necessary to re-educate the community about why, I'm sorry, it's not time yet, you can't go party in the streets. But of course, all of this is aggravated by political activities that are in the streets, whether it's protests about the murder of George Floyd or it's the president calling for a massive rally. There is a certain calculus made by individuals. At this moment, I can be less than 6 feet away from another person because there's a higher cause. I think it's inevitable there will be infections unless somehow there's a big change in what the Republicans decide is the appropriate behavior in that rally in Tulsa. I'm very worried also about a lot of the anti-racism protesters.
Also, the ones in the streets, most seem to be wearing masks and they were outdoors. The ones in Tulsa apparently are not expressing concern about masks and they will be indoors. So we'll keep an eye on that and the concern about that. What other concerns are you hearing?
There's a pretty vigorous debate going on among those who specialize in the modeling, forecasting epidemics. Some of them are projecting a kind of slow burn for North America, where we sort of smolder, and that would have a steady state in death toll and a steady state in hospitalization, which would take you out to September with a very considerable death toll. Now, there's a lot of difference in the models. Some see it more like a series of waves from now until then. As we see right now, we're seeing sort of the impact of the Memorial Day weekend partying. Some models have us hitting about 200,000 people dead in America by mid-August, and others take it all the way out to October. My personal opinion is that we will continue to see sort of mini waves of surging, and that these will come typically 10 days to 2 weeks after reopening events or specific forms of entertainment or activity, and that this will go on into September, and we will hit 200,000 dead Americans sometime around Labor Day, maybe even sooner. And then that we will be hit by another really big wave after we get into colder weather again.
Make the case to Secretary Mnuchin, then, that the economy is not worth those lives.
I don't think that argument will work with them. I'm not really sure that lost lives is an issue for certain people in the White House. I think the better argument is this. The OECD has done its predictions. This is the Club of Rich Nations, if you will. It's done its predictions and forecasts of GDP loss across the richest countries in the world. For the United States, they're predicting a loss of negative 8.5% GDP by the end of this year. We haven't been at negative 8.5 GDP in my lifetime. I mean, the kinds of severe economic shocks we're going to experience are far beyond the Band-Aid prescriptions, the trillion here, the trillion there of liquidity infused into the market. We either stop this epidemic or we have economic collapse.
A couple quick questions. When do we stop it? Anthony Fauci said that he feels there might be a vaccine the beginning of the coming year. Your thoughts on when one might come?
So we have about 300 different kinds of products, including vaccines, in pipelines in various countries around the world. And my concern, of course, is that in our pell-mell rush, safety may take a back seat. And the problem with safety taking a back seat is that it fuels all the sort of anti-pharmaceutical, anti-vaccine movements. And we already have one poll done by Pew that shows 27% of Americans say they flatly would refuse a COVID vaccine. So we have a really big problem here. If there's anything wrong with a product and it goes out too quickly and it's not adequately tested for longer term effects, and then there are claims, real or not, then I think we're going to be Sisyphus rolling a rock straight up a 90-degree angle trying to get herd immunity.
Sounds like it's the same as the thinking with the economy. Do it slower and get it right. I got polio in 55. When the first vaccine came out, it was flawed, and people were getting polio from that vaccine that eventually became the life-saving polio vaccine. So this has happened before. Lori, before we let you go, why do you think this has been so hard to get the seriousness of this pandemic across to so many people? Is it because we can't see it? We don't see people on ventilators. We don't see people struggling to breathe. We saw children paralyzed in, you know, the back of their parents' station wagons being pulled up to hospitals, you know, with polio. Is it because we can't really see how bad it is?
Well, I don't know what more you need to see. I mean, in March and April here in New York, we had giant refrigerator trucks parked outside of hospitals all over the whole city, and everybody knew they were full of dead bodies. What more do you need to see? We have thousands of people hanging out their windows every night at 7 o'clock, shouting and screaming and banging cans for the healthcare workers. Do you want the bodies laid on the sidewalk for the cameras? I mean, one of the problems with this epidemic is that it's really been heavily driven in some states by nursing home outbreaks. You know, most of America doesn't think about people in nursing homes. They're warehoused old people. We've already written them off. It's okay that we're losing the World War II generation. It's okay we're losing the Korean War and Vietnam War generation. It's okay that it's sweeping through VA retirement centers and nursing homes. What the hell? It's just a bunch of old people. Well, anybody who has that attitude needs some serious reality checking, just like they're getting some reality checking now that they're thinking seriously about the implications of the George Floyd murder. And it's time that we stop having such a callous attitude. You might not see it. They're not rolled out on the sidewalk for your public viewing. And maybe you don't care about people over 80 years old. Maybe you think anybody that's lived to be 70 has had an adequate life. I don't happen to agree. I find it deeply offensive.
Lori Garrett, Pulitzer Prize-winning author, emerging disease expert, go-to on this topic. Lori, thank you so much, as always.
You bet. Take care, folks.
And we know George Floyd's killer hasn't been tried yet. We don't use the word murder. Thoughts on COVID-19? Go to hereandnow.org. As Americans take to the streets in Black Lives Matter protests, the pandemic threatens the survival of historically Black colleges and universities. But there's some hope on the horizon as Congress agrees to additional funding, and administrators in North Carolina, where more HBCU students graduate every year than any other state, say that may keep them afloat. WUNC's Liz Schlemmer reports.
Maria Lumpkin was drawn to St. Augustine's University years ago. She remembers driving through campus in Raleigh and seeing the historic stone chapel built by students in 1895.
I fell in love with the campus, and I fell in love with the spirit of the people that were there.
Lumpkin became interim president of her alma mater in March, just as the gravity of the pandemic was taking hold.
These past few months presented lots of challenges unlike any we've seen.
Rodriguez Murray is a lobbyist with the United Negro College Fund, an organization that represents private HBCUs, including St. Augustine's. He jumped into emergency mode on March 12th.
The president of one of our colleges and universities called me at 9 o'clock that evening and said that if they don't get help because of the conditions of this pandemic, that college expects to be in the hole between $2 and $4 million this year.
HBCUs are up against many financial challenges. They've been historically underfunded. Generations of wealth inequality for Black Americans have left HBCUs with smaller endowments and a high percentage of low-income students. For some HBCUs, says Murray, the costs of the pandemic could threaten their survival.
We've been through the Great Depression. We've been through Jim Crow and segregation. The institutions have no desire to fold now.
Three HBCUs have closed since the last recession. Others, including St. Augustine's, have risked losing their accreditation in recent years due to finances. With high stakes in mind, Murray joined forces with North Carolina Congresswoman and HBCU alum Alma Adams.
One of the things that I pledged to do when I came to Congress was to continue to support the schools that supported me.
At the start of the pandemic, she and others pushed Congress to help HBCUs, and they responded with about $1.4 billion. Murray says that still might not be enough, but it's far more than HBCUs have received in past crises.
We have a history of getting targeted resources to the schools, never this big and never this fast.
Lumpkin says the additional funding for HBCUs more than doubled the relief funding that St. Augustine's would have otherwise received.
This is huge for us. Without that funding, we would certainly not have the resources to be able to support the shift.
St. Augustine's will spend most of that on technology, and they're not alone. Peggy Valentine is the interim chancellor of Fayetteville State University. She recalled a student who was sharing one laptop with her four school-aged children.
These are challenges that many of our students, especially African-American students from low-income communities, face on a daily basis, having to make do with limited resources.
Valentine says whether they'll have enough money to avoid laying off staff depends on state funding.
If we continue to receive the amount of appropriations from the states we have in the past few years, then we will be okay.
Meanwhile, at St. Augustine's, fall enrollment looks good, but President Lumpkin doesn't know yet how much the pandemic will cost her university.
But I will say this, we will spend all the money that we have and more.
For Here and Now, I'm Liz Schlemmer.
Do you remember what was going on 5 years ago today? That was the day when Donald Trump came down the escalator and said he was running for president. This afternoon, President Trump announced his proposal for police reforms amid widespread social unrest and a pandemic, and he is moving ahead with plans for a huge indoor rally in Tulsa, Oklahoma, this weekend. NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro joins us now to talk about the presidential race. Hi, Domenico.
Hey, Jeremy.
Well, let's start with that rally. This is going to be the first one in months. There will be temperature checks at the rally in Tulsa. Masks will be distributed, but not mandatory. And attendees are going to have to sign waivers saying that they're responsible if they get sick. Now, there is some talk of moving the rally outdoors, which health experts say would be safer. But what is at stake for President Trump with this rally on Saturday?
Well, right now they are keeping it indoors, from what we understand, at the Box Center in Tulsa, 20,000 seat capacity or thereabouts. You know, that's a lot of people tightly crammed together into one arena. And, you know, President Trump really wants to show that he's getting everything back to normal. But we are seeing spikes in a lot of states across the country, especially in the South, you know, and this is one of those things where he had one controversy where he was holding the rally on Friday, which was Juneteenth, after almost 100 years of one of the worst massacres of, you know, of racial violence in the country, and then moved it to Saturday and dealing with a different controversy when it comes to COVID-19. And that last part that you mentioned, having people sign off basically a waiver saying they won't sue the campaign, seems to be a recognition, at least, that there is some danger of having this many people in a small, crowded into a big space.
Well, and the other thing is that he's kind of made a point of not wearing a mask. So it's going to be interesting to see if his supporters feel like they can wear masks in a Trump rally. We'll have to see. What about Joe Biden? Is he going to be holding rallies anytime soon, do you think?
He doesn't have any plans to have any rallies anytime soon. He is going to be making a stop in Darby, Pennsylvania, as that county starts to reopen a little bit. It's one of the few early indicators of Biden getting out there a little bit, you know, but clearly not trying to hold any kind of rally. You'll probably see him in public with a mask on. And it really does indicate the big difference between the two parties and their view, frankly, of masculinity. You know, what is the right way to act if you're a man? You know, is that a manly way to be, to not have a mask on? And I still find it ironic that President Trump is the reason why everybody started wearing masks in the first place, because he went to the podium and said, hey, you know, wearing a scarf or a face covering can actually slow down the spread of the virus. Mm-hmm. So everyone did it. And then he said, yeah, you know what? I'm not going to do it, and created this whole controversy.
Well, the next big thing after the rallies is going to be the political conventions. And President Trump has said his nomination will be accepted in Jacksonville, Florida, not Charlotte, North Carolina, where the Republican convention will be, because the restrictions are looser in Florida. And in an interview today, I asked South Carolina Democratic Congressman James Clyburn if Joe Biden should accept the Democratic Party nomination in front of a crowd. Here's what he said.
I think he ought to accept it like a leader of this country ought to accept it, utilizing the best practices when dealing with a pandemic. This whole thing of needing a crowd in order to boost your ego, I don't think the vice president needs that.
Now, he's very close with the vice president, but what do you think the Democratic convention, Domenico, is going to look like?
Well, I think it'll be something between a Zoom convention and a big rally. You know, it's not going to quite be the kinds of rallies I think we're used to seeing. But, you know, you could, in a big arena, not have sort of all the extra guests that might be there and have people spread out every 6 feet within the arena or outside, you know, like you're mentioning, and the vice president, former vice president, wearing a mask. Or, you know, I think it's going to look very different than what we've seen in the past, and it's going to look different mm-hmm. than what Republicans certainly want to do.
Domenico, I don't want to focus too much on polls 4.5 months out, but it is clear in the polls that have been coming out that there's been a shift in Joe Biden's direction. He's up by 16 points in a poll out today in Michigan. On average, he's ahead of Trump in Florida, Arizona, Ohio, Wisconsin. Texas is looking competitive. How worried is the Trump campaign about this?
You know, they may not say so out front, but they are worried about it behind the scenes. I mean, they have to be, because the landscape has completely shifted. If we're talking about Ohio being back on the map, then that's a big problem for President Trump. You know, look, some of the polls in states like Michigan and Wisconsin were wrong in 2016. But, you know, the polls in Michigan on average had Hillary Clinton up by about 4 points in 2016, not 16 points. That's certainly mm-hmm. way outside the margin of error and has to have the Trump campaign quite concerned, even if they won't say so publicly.
Domenico Montanaro, NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, protesters in Detroit are demanding that city end its contract with a provider of facial recognition software that studies have shown has trouble identifying black faces. In response to some of the nationwide protests this month, Amazon, IBM, and Microsoft said they would scale back their use of facial recognition software. Let's bring in Ina Fried. She's chief technology correspondent at Axios. Hi, Ina.
Hey, Jeremy.
Well, and IBM last week announced it will no longer sell general-purpose facial recognition technology, citing its role in what the company called mass surveillance, racial profiling, and violations of basic human rights and freedoms. What exactly is the issue with facial recognition software in particular?
Well, there are two really big issues. The first is, how accurate is it? As you mentioned, there have been studies that show that it's less accurate with black and brown faces than it is with white faces, which obviously is a problem no matter how you use the technology. But that exacerbates the second problem, which is, how should facial recognition be used, especially by law enforcement? Some folks feel like there's no place for it. Others want to see very clear rules. But right now, it's pretty much anything goes.
It's anything goes. There's no regulation out there right now for the use of AI and facial recognition technology, for example, by the police?
Not at the national level. Some states and municipalities have passed either rules or bans on police use of facial recognition, but there's not a national policy, despite calls from, interestingly, both companies and activists for national legislation. They want different things, but they're both calling for national legislation.
Well, and so IBM, we talked about what they're doing. Amazon said it's placing a one-year moratorium on police use of the company's facial recognition technology. Microsoft's president said last week that his company does not sell facial recognition to the police and promised not to do so until there's better legislation regulating it. Is what these companies are doing as monumental as it sounds, or is there wiggle room in the language?
There's a lot of wiggle room. So IBM is getting out of the business. So that's pretty clear. Amazon and Microsoft are both pledging different sorts of pauses. But there's also wiggle room around the word police. You know, it sounds pretty unambiguous, but we weren't able to get either Amazon or Microsoft to be clear whether that also includes federal law enforcement, anything from the FBI to agencies like Customs and Border Patrol and ICE. So all we know is police, probably meaning here local police. The other issue is these are temporary pauses, especially with Amazon. It's not clear if that pause is just to let the dust settle or if they're really committed to not using the technology until there are clear guidelines in place.
Now, the problem of inherent bias in tech goes far beyond facial recognition. And you write in Axios that the recession, the economic situation, is going to make it easier for cash-strapped companies and public agencies to rely on algorithms to make decisions in things like housing, credit, and employment, as well as policing.
Yeah, facial recognition gets the most attention, but one of the clear things that we need to pay attention to is how algorithms, how these software bits are making decisions instead of humans. So with predictive policing, it's telling police where to go. With software, it's saying who should get a loan, who should get a job. These are really important decisions. And one of the things about algorithms is they're only as good as the people that write them. And in many cases, they bring over our human biases. So while facial recognition is super important, it's only the tip of the iceberg.
That is Ina Fried, Chief Technology Correspondent at Axios. Ina, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Beyoncé has added her voice to those calling for the police who killed Breonna Taylor to be charged. On March 13th, 2 months before George Floyd was killed, Taylor, a 25-year-old black EMT, was in her apartment in Louisville, Kentucky, when police burst in with a no-knock warrant. Her boyfriend, thinking they were intruders, fired a shot. The police returned fire, killing Breonna. That led to the passage of Breonna's Law, which now prohibits no-knock warrants in Louisville. But our next guest asks why it took the terrible death of George Floyd to bring attention to Breonna and other black women killed by police. Kimberly Crenshaw is a professor of law at UCLA and Columbia Law and executive director of the African American Policy Forum, which launched the Say Her Name campaign to bring awareness. And Professor, some say it takes a video to do that. Now, you say there weren't videos of other black men killed, Michael Brown, for instance, and there have been of women. Explain.
Look for Natasha McKenna, who was a black woman who was tasered to death, who was being brought out of a cell in a mental health crisis. The real challenge is that because we don't have a "I've heard that one before" response, their stories tend to just sort of dissipate into the ether. Had what happened on March 13th not happened just before two very high-profile killings of black men, we probably wouldn't be saying Breonna Taylor's name either. Michelle Cousseau was actually killed about 5 days after Mike Brown. There were no protests. There were no cameras. There were no demands for accountability when a police officer went to her home on a mental health call and shot her through the heart within seconds of encountering her. But I have to say that her mother, Fran Garrett, organized a protest taking her daughter's casket to the Phoenix City Hall. That's where we saw that a black woman had been killed and no one was saying her name. So we started collecting other names of black women who were killed by the police. And going to the protests around Mike Brown and Eric Garner, we went with a banner of the names of black women who were killed and basically said, "Say her name, say her name."
There is so much to talk about here, the history of women like Fannie Lou Hamer, beaten by police, and then leading the protests against police violence. I mean, they have to kind of do it all. But I was wondering, women, of course, suffered terribly during slavery, raped, torn from children. Men also suffered terribly, but might also have been seen as being emasculated, you know, the white man's foot on their neck. And I'm wondering if, you know, these violent images we see now are, you know, I don't know, they speak to that emasculation somehow? I mean, do you think there's something there?
I'm so glad you asked that, Robin, because it goes to the point about why it's so hard to conceptualize anti-Black violence against women. For our entire history of slavery and efforts to challenge it, the way that it's experienced by men has been at the center of it. And that has created a narrative about what anti-Black racism looks like that is accurate, but it is not entirely inclusive. So you pointed out that much of what happened to Black women all the way back in slavery was basically sexual violence and a lot of stereotypes that had to be generated to make that seem acceptable. So we respond to George Floyd's killing because it's so amplifying what we know racism to have been about. But we don't know those stories about Black women. We don't tell the stories about the disrespect that Black women experience. So not too surprisingly, when the police treat Black women in ways that are continuous with that legacy, we don't have the stories. We don't have the framework. That's our problem right now. You've got to really dig underneath to find what's happening to Black women.
Well, and in the time we have, just briefly mention what's happening to Black trans women. Last week, 27-year-old Dominique Remy Fells in Philadelphia, 25-year-old Raya Milton in Cincinnati, both killed. You're known for coining the term intersectionality, how vulnerable people are when these different identities intersect, Black, transgender. We need to look there too.
And I would say the important thing here is racism, transphobia, and misogyny. That is something that we have to continue to hold up when we talk about the deaths of Black women across the gender spectrum. Black women have the highest rates of homicide in the country. It is the reality of living life in a Black body that makes you more subject to police violence. Now, if that body happens to be gendered as something other than male, it also makes you vulnerable to being misremembered. That's something that we can do something about. That's something that Say Her Name is attending to.
That's Kimberly Crenshaw, professor of law at UCLA and Columbia, also co-founder and executive director of the African American Policy Forum behind the Say Her Name campaign. Professor Kimberly, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.